Your Honors, good morning. My name is Ryan Robertson. I represent Earl Suchek this morning, if I may reserve 3 minutes.
All right.
This case involves a license suspension imposed under the implied consent law. In 2015, our legislature expanded what is called the safely off the roadway defense in RCW 4661502 sub 4, a defense that applies to charges of being in physical control of a motor vehicle under the influence of intoxicants, expanded it to apply to civil license suspension proceedings where the underlying allegation is physical control. At issue in this case is whether that defense applied to Mr. Suchek. Initially, I need to bring up the fact, as I stated in our pleadings, that the hearing officer failed to properly apply this issue at the hearing level. The hearing officer misconstrued the challenge, not as an affirmative defense, which it is, but as a challenge to probable cause for the underlying arrest. As a consequence, we have no findings that properly address the issues that we address in the appeal today.
But the underlying issue here seems to be whether or not the amendment to which you referred that grants an affirmative defense in these circumstances applies, right?
Yes, Your Honor, to both issues.
Okay. So with respect to that amendment, your argument in your briefing is that the triggering date is the hearing.
Yes.
Why is that correct?
The statutory language, as I recall, states that the defense applies to any action pursuant to the implied consent law. There's no definition of what action means. And in fact, the department, in raising the issue to say that it applies to the commencement of the suspension and not the hearing, offers no legal authority to support its claim. What we're asking the court to do is to harmonize not only the affirmative defense language, but also the entirety of the language under the implied consent law. When the department initiates a suspension, several things occur. One, there is notice that your license is going to be suspended, and then there's also the opportunity for a hearing. It's only at the hearing is the evidence of the case considered. When the suspension notice goes out, there's no review of the case. The department receives a sworn report.
Would a different rule of law apply if the hearing had been continued? Let's say the first hearing date was scheduled before the effective date of the statute and the second was continued to a date after the effective date of the statute. Would the statute suddenly apply?
It's our argument that the affirmative defense would apply at the time of the hearing because that is the first opportunity the driver has to raise an affirmative defense. Affirmative defenses cannot be considered by the department on their own. An individual has to concede the underlying activity that they were in physical control of a vehicle under the influence of alcohol. The affirmative defense pleads an excuse. When the legislature crafted the language,
could
any action
settle the case before hearing with a letter from defendant's counsel comes and says, here's the evidence we're going to present in opposition to the suspension of Mr. So-and-so's license. Did the department at that point say, you know, that's persuasive, we're going to withdraw the suspension action?
That's theoretically possible, Your Honor, but that never happens in an administrative proceeding.
But it's within the authority of the department?
No. The only time the department considers the evidence is when there is a hearing scheduled and at the hearing.
That is an answer. Is it within the authority of the department to be persuaded by that letter and withdraw the suspension?
No, there's no authority. It's all dictated by statute. The only time the department considers the evidence of the case is when a hearing was requested, and on the hearing itself, all evidence is admitted without evidentiary foundation and then considered. So you could present the department a million things.
Admitted without evidentiary foundation?
Yes, Your Honor. There's no such thing as hearsay. There's no such thing as certifications under CRRLJ 6.13. If you submit it, it is considered.
Well, counsel, you seem to be saying that this is really a moving target depending on the circumstances of the case, and that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense.
Are we talking about
the effective date of the application of this statute to persons who are brought before the Department of Licensing?
So,
say in response to Judge Leach that if there's a continuance, then the date of the hearing down the road dictates the applicability, and that doesn't seem to make sense.
So the language is any action. It doesn't state an action commenced on a particular date. The statutory language is not clear. And as I said,
well, we often have to deal with the legislative language that is not clear. And so one of the principles of construction is to determine what makes sense under all the circumstances.
And the court can look at dictionary definitions, which I provide, both a Blacks and Merriam-Webster. And under both of those definitions, the term action includes the entirety of a legal proceeding, not the commencement of the proceeding. So it is possible that a proceeding, an action,
a six-day proceeding on the fifth day, the effect is the fifth day of the statute. The rule of law changes during the trial.
Your Honor, that is an interesting question. That is not applicable here because the hearing occurred
beyond your case, and that seems like an absurd thing that the rule of law could change during the proceeding.
Your Honor, and I don't know if this rule or this defense anticipates that. It is possible for a proceeding to fall on both sides of an effective date of a law, just like in Pilatos, where the requirement of impaneling a jury for enhancements was a law that occurred before the plea, but after the charging document, after the crime had been committed. So it certainly is possible that a proceeding can encompass both before an effective date and after an effective date. The point is that it says any action, not a particular action, and not a particular subset of an action. It says any action. And in terms of harmonizing it with how you are able to present this defense, I mean, it is never considered at any other time. It is not considered by the department. You can't raise it until you have your hearing, your day in court. And I would note that the Godfrey decision, we're talking about the alterations to contributory negligence back in the early 1970s, this court said, there is no vested right to an affirmative defense. You get what you get at trial.
And we looked at the effective date as being the date when your action is filed, didn't we?
Not in that case. The effective date was the date that you were in court and could actually apply the defense. Thank you.
You have your 3 minutes. You may.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, April Benson on behalf of the Department of Licensing. It's a question of fact whether a driver who has been arrested for physical control established the affirmative defense that he moved the vehicle safely off the roadway before being pursued by law enforcement. This Court should affirm the hearing officer's determination that Sushek did not prove the defense because substantial evidence demonstrates he neither drove nor caused his vehicle to be moved off the roadway before the officer approached him asleep and slumped over in the driver's seat of a running car.
Do we need to get to that if, in fact, we reach the conclusion that the amendment does not apply, the amendment which gives the affirmative defense does not apply?
No, Your Honor. The court could affirm on either ground. And given that Mr. Sushek and the court have focused more on the timing question, I'll jump right there. The court should affirm the revocation as Mr. Sushek was not entitled to raise this defense. The department took action to revoke his driving privilege on September 1st of 2015, which was more than 3 weeks before the statutory amendment went into effect. So as a matter of law, he was not entitled to raise this defense at his implied consent hearing. His hearing occurred about 2 months after the effective date of the statutory amendment. The statutory amendments are presumed to operate prospectively, and in every case addressing this question of prospective application versus retroactive application, we start with the presumption it's going to operate prospectively and look for a triggering event, which has always been a determinate event, a determinate date, and not any part of a process or, as Your Honor aptly described it, as a moving target. Here, the language of the amendment said that it is an affirmative defense to any action pursuant to RCW 4623.08 to suspend, revoke, or deny the privilege to drive if, prior to being pursued by law enforcement, the person had moved their vehicle safely off the roadway. So the triggering event here is the department's action pursuant to RCW 4623.08 to suspend, revoke, or deny the privilege to drive. If you pull out the phrase, any action, by itself, it might appear to be questionable or ambiguous. But in context, it says any action pursuant to the implied consent statute to suspend, revoke, or deny. And the department's action to revoke a driver's license under 4623.08 begins when the department receives an arrest report and issues its notice of revocation to the driver. The court recognized this as the first step in the implied consent process in the Frank decision.
You said earlier that all of the cases provide for a determinate triggering event. But counsel argues this Godfrey case and saying that was one where, you know, it just depended on when you as a defendant decided to assert the defense. How would you distinguish Godfrey?
Well, Godfrey is different, Your Honor, because the court was looking at the type of remedy that was available in a negligence case. And they said it didn't change the liability as the consequence of negligence, but instead just the measure of the remedy. And since it was expressly about a remedy.
Not about a defense?
It's about an affirmative defense, but it's solely about the measure of a remedy and therefore remedial and retroactive. But this is about more than something that's just remedial, and it shouldn't be retroactive. And Mr. Sushek has never conceded that the statute or has never argued that the statute should be read retroactively. He wants this triggering event to be a moving target that's part of a process. If the legislature wanted to make this defense available at any hearing or to any driver who had not yet had a hearing, it could have said so. But instead, it made this defense available to those who had not yet had action against them pursuant to the implied consent statute. The legislature actually showed in the very same session law, House Bill 1276 from 2015, that if it wanted to make this defense available at a hearing and therefore make the hearing occurring as the triggering event, it knows how to do that. In Section 5 of the same session law, the legislature amended the implied consent statute to make different affirmative defenses available in these hearings. This other defense has to do with the timing of when the person consumed alcohol or marijuana. But there the legislature again amended a statute and said that the person may petition the hearing officer to apply the affirmative defense found in, and then they cite the other affirmative defenses at issue, and also said that the driver has the burden to prove this affirmative defense by a preponderance of the evidence. But here, in the statutory amendment at issue, the legislature used different language. They said it's a defense to any action pursuant to the implied consent statute to suspend, revoke, or deny the driving privilege. Different language means something different. The legislature did not make this a defense that's available that the person may petition the hearing officer to apply, as it did for the pre-test consumption defense.
So you're saying that those other defenses in Section 5 and 6, that those establish non-determinate dates?
I'm saying for the other affirmative defenses that were added in Section 5 of the same session law, the triggering event is, in fact, the hearing, which is what Mr. Sushek wants here. But for this defense, the triggering event is not the hearing. It's whether the department has taken an action pursuant to the implied consent.
But so then that argument somewhat contradicts your earlier statement that it's always a determinate event because a hearing.
Well, a hearing is a determinate event, and that's similar to other circumstances like in Pilatos and Flint where they look to see whether, for instance, a person's been released from custody yet or has had a third community custody violation. But it's clear in this other context the legislature wanted those defenses to be available at a hearing, and they're a defense that could be raised before the hearing officer, but this defense is an affirmative defense to an action, which then should begin to apply prospectively to those actions that take place after the effective date of the statutory amendment.
Is there a case that says that what the department does when it sends the notice out is initiating a, quote, action, unquote?
I'm not aware of a case, Your Honor, interpreting the word action, but in Frank versus Department of Licensing, they do talk about the process and the fact that the process begins when the department receives the arrest report and issues the notice of revocation. And it's also significant because there needs to be a determinate event. It makes sense that it would be the first event because otherwise there's no way to know. Besides these questions we've been talking about a particular hearing, what about a driver who has had a hearing before the effective date of the statutory amendment, but the hearing officer hasn't yet issued a decision? Or a driver who has had a hearing officer's decision but appealed to Superior Court and maybe did or didn't get a stay. I mean, under Mr. Sushek's argument, any of these drivers who are anywhere in the implied consent process would be entitled to raise this defense. But
well, not every driver asked for a hearing. And oftentimes in a criminal case where someone's charged with driving after the license has been suspended or revoked, the question is whether that notice went out was actually sent in the appropriate way required by the statute so that the department can show that it actually suspended the license. So that can be the suspension action. There doesn't have to be a hearing.
That's correct, Your Honor. And particularly with other drivers similarly situated to Mr. Sushek, because the effective date of this amendment began more than 20 days after he was arrested and given his notice of revocation, other drivers may possibly have not requested a hearing at all, assuming that they were not entitled to raise this defense. But Mr. Sushek is acting on the luck of the timing of his case, that he was arrested before the statutory amendment and his hearing occurred after the date of it.
You don't think that it might begin with the arrest itself, that could be the triggering event when the officer writes out a citation?
Oh, I think in the appropriate case it could. And in fact, the implied consent statute has the officer actually give the driver the notice of revocation as well. But that's not – so what happens is the person's arrested for DUI or physical control. The officer actually gives them a notice that DOL intends to suspend their license, but then the officer also has to follow up and submit an arrest report to DOL. DOL issues a second sort of courtesy notice confirming we've received this report and your license will be suspended on such and such date. But the arrest date is, in fact, significant because it's usually – except – you know, when there's other timing factors at issue, like blood tests, it's usually the date from which the driver has 20 days to request a hearing.
Well, I mean, in this case, it doesn't matter. But suppose you had a case where the effective date of the statute was in between the officer's arrest and whatever the DOL notice is that starts the action in your current argument.
That's an interesting question, Your Honor, and I'm not sure since it's not the facts of this case, but the department's action begins formally when it receives the arrest report and issues the notice.
So wouldn't you be safer saying it starts no later than when that notice comes out to save your other argument for another day?
I think that's a great way to phrase it, Your Honor. Mr. Sushek failed to prove the defense, and he wasn't entitled to raise it because of the timing of the statutory amendment. The department would ask you to affirm.
Thank you.
Your Honors, we do argue in our pleadings that the Affirmative Defense Amendment is a remedial act, and this is why Godfrey is so critical. It's a remedial act because it applies or relates to practice, procedure, or remedy. That's exactly the situation in Godfrey.
But it gives a substantive defense. Why is that?
Well, an affirmative defense
to
is
be
not
disregarded.
An affirmative defense is not a substantive change in law. It doesn't change the elements of the offense, doesn't change the penalty for an offense. We're talking about something that a defendant can raise. In Godfrey, when the legislature modified contributory negligence from a complete bar to a percentage, they used remarkably same language, that the act said that in an act of negligence, the remedy shall be this proportion. So they use the term an act or an action in the legislative language. Godfrey writes.
That's quite a different. Is it act or is it action or both? Act is different from action.
In an action. Contributory negligence shall not bar recovery in an action.
Okay.
So what Godfrey writes is, we also hold that there is no vested right to a common law bar to recovery that is provided by the affirmative defense of contributory negligence. A defendant has no vested right in a tort defense, the merits of which are not determined until a subsequent trial and upon which he did not and could not have relied upon when the accident happened. What Godfrey is contemplating is that if the action commences prior to the change in law, that the contributory negligence defense, as it has been amended, still applies when the case goes to trial. They did not argue or show a concern about a defendant dragging their feet through the litigation process to suddenly or excuse me, a plaintiff, I should say, dragging their feet through the litigation to be able to spare themselves from being shut out if they were in some way proportionally negligent in the action. It was when the trial occurred. So a remedial act is something like an affirmative defense. It is not a vested right. You cannot rely upon it. Certainly you can't rely upon it to challenge probable cause. You have to go to court to raise your affirmative defense. That means that this law goes into effect when it goes into effect. And it went into effect in September, and Mr. Sushek's hearing was in November. And therefore, he was entitled to rely upon that defense as it applied at his hearing. One thing I would ask this court to consider if it chooses to...
But didn't the court say in Godfrey that the one, I mean, one of the things they said is that the statute did not create or abolish a statutory defense?
Correct.
This one does.
Right? Well, the affirmative defense has existed since 1979.
To a criminal charge.
And this
but
merely
Godfrey
expanded.
Godfrey is a civil case, and you're relying on what can happen in a civil case.
Yes, but the civil case...
Contributory fault was a common law bar rather than a statutory bar, wasn't it?
Yes, that's the language that the court uses in Godfrey.
Does that make a difference, too?
Your Honor, I would submit that affirmative defenses are all the same and should be treated the same. This was not a new affirmative defense. It was an affirmative defense that existed and expanded to encompass not only the criminal conduct, but now it expanded the civil suspension as well, and that's why we believe it's germane to the case.
Thank you.
Thank you.